A recent study found that 70% of young people between the ages of 16 and 25 are extremely worried or very worried about the climate. The latest assessment that the global temperature is rising faster than previously predicted has added urgency for action and radical changes. Climate and sustainability are inherently intergenerational, as we must think about our consumption and using our environment in a way that is compatible with maintaining it for future generations. What are the roles young people play to increase awareness and ensure sustainability and a better future for all? How do we foster intergenerational solidarity to create positive synergies and push forward change? My name is Zoe Leung, Senior Director of Research at the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Today, I'm so happy to welcome two guests to discuss climate issues from the perspectives of young people. Charles Hua is an undergraduate at Harvard College, majoring in statistics and mathematics with a minor in energy and environment. He currently serves on the board of directors for the environmental nonprofits Clean Wisconsin, Energy News Network, and Slipstream. Aruna Muthupile is a freshman and Dedman Scholar at the University of Texas at Austin, majoring in international relations and global studies. Both Charles and Aruna participated in the U.S.-China cross-generational initiative we launched earlier this year to bring Gen Zers on as equal and natural partners in a range of policy discussions. Charles and Aruna, welcome to our podcast and great to chat with you both again.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great, let's get started. Aruna, let me start with you. How did you get interested in climate issues? Have you or your peers faced any age-related barriers in taking actions to address climate change?
Yeah, so I first began my interest in addressing climate issues in the summer of 2017. That was post the Trump election in 2016. And I think that was more of a United States movement towards addressing climate-based issues, especially when we saw that a government in power wasn't going to do much to stop them and even go as much as deny them. So I started working with Citizens Climate Lobby and traveled to Washington, D.C. multiple times to advocate for carbon-based initiatives to prevent the onset of climate change. And ever since then, I've just been interested in it all along. And in terms of age-related barriers, I think there's many. Within my own high school, there was an organization called Parallel Youth Movement, and we tried to have a climate strike along with Greta Thunberg. This was probably around 2019 or 2020. And we faced a lot of institutional barriers to doing this because we had to navigate a political climate in Texas in which climate change is seen as more of a partisan issue than as a worldwide problem that everyone needs to work together to address. And so we were prevented on many fronts, including silencing. We were threatened with suspension for doing this strike and placed with a lot of restrictions. And I think just nationwide, a lot of youth climate activists feel the sense that they aren't being heard. And also they aren't taken seriously because they aren't as quote unquote experienced as other people.
I want to go to you now, Charles. You've been engaging in climate related work since age 15. Tell me about your experience and how things have shifted over the past few years.
Thanks, Zoe. It's interesting. My first engagement on climate change actually started in second grade when my teacher taught our class about climate change. We discussed Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. And I was really moved at even that young age. And at the end of the year for our class newspaper project, where we each had to write a newspaper article, I ended up writing mine about solar panels and solar technology. And in high school, when I was 15, I started an effort to raise money for solar panels at our school. And we met with some initial resistance from the school district administration for pursuing the project, but we were able to raise $150,000, get the panels installed. And then we started a campaign to petition our school district to pass a 100% renewable energy goal. And a year later, they were able to pass that resolution, and they became actually the largest school district in the country at that time in 2019 with that commitment. And through that process, I realized how difficult of an issue even something like getting one organization to accelerate the clean energy transition could be in terms of the range of different stakeholders that needed to be involved. In our case, it was the school district, it was the local electric utility, it was the community, it was students, staff, parents, and broader community residents. And so there were a lot of different interests and stakeholders that we needed to pull together on that. And I became, frankly, addicted to thinking about climate change. And in college, I really wanted to study more and do more research on this topic. I was taking courses ranging from the technologies, the technological aspects of renewable energy, to environmental economics, to climate policy and climate politics. And I realized just how truly fascinating, interdisciplinary, and complex this issue could be. And so I think throughout this entire journey, to get at your question about sort of how things have changed and maybe how age-related issues have come to the fore, I would point to two things. First, I would say that youth perspectives have become increasingly valued. It was something where towards the start of my engagement on climate, it was the number one thing on my mind is how do I build credibility to be able to engage productively in this? You know, people saw me as somebody who lacked decades of the experience and technical expertise that's necessary to really address this challenge head on. But, you know, now I think that there's an increasing recognition that young people actually, you know, what they lack in terms of years of industry experience, they make up for in terms of a passion and urgency for the issue and an ability to see the big picture and connect the dots between, you know, systems of economics to society, to technology, to law, and how all these different dimensions fit in together. I think that's the first thing. And I think the second thing is that there's an increasing recognition that justice and equity and fairness are important components of the clean energy transition. I remember when I started working in climate change in high school, where topics like environmental justice or the global south were relegated to the margins of any climate reports that I read. You know, maybe it was discussed in the first page and the last page, but not in between. And now I think if we think about within the US, for example, environmental justice is an increasingly important component of climate solutions. And environmental justice communities have a ton of valuable perspectives and power to bring to the conversation. But on the global stage, when we think about the UN Climate Conference and the importance of issues like loss and damage and sustainable and climate finance to help low-income and developing countries navigate sustainable development in the clean energy transition, I think there's an increasing recognition that we need to accelerate climate solutions and clean energy technologies, but also do it in a way that makes sure that there's a global leveling of the playing field and make sure that all stakeholders can benefit from the clean energy transition.
Now, I wonder what you both think about education. Is today's education preparing young people with the values, knowledge, and skill sets needed to effectively meet long-term challenges like climate change?
I think that it really depends on what type of education we're talking about. I think there's a wealth of information online that is a resource for young people to learn more about the climate and what they can do about it. But on the other hand, if you are placed in a situation, for example, you're in a marginalized school district or your school district was like mine and prefers to silence rather than educate, I think they're really, it's very difficult to find your footing and really get to understand the issues that you're talking about. Because a lot of the times, if anyone's experience is similar to mine, it's that your school district or the people around you, especially in the South, will do anything to say that climate change is not real, it's not legitimate. And if it is, fossil fuels aren't the problem or humans aren't the problem. It's just something that's been happening, which is completely illegitimate. But they'll try to do anything to silence the voices of science and anything that has to do with it. For example, even in our environmental science classes, which was dictated by the College Board curriculum, we weren't allowed to explicitly say that climate change was human developed, even though that was part of the curriculum, because our school district just would not allow it. So I think that if young people want to find that information, it's there, but there's external challenges that make it definitely more difficult for students to get involved or even learn more about it because they're being discouraged to do so by those around them.
I would break it up into two main kind of components of education. One is sort of the hard skills, you know, the very technical dimensions of addressing climate change, whether it's the economic, the political, the technological, or engineering, or the legal perspectives. And also the other bucket of kind of the soft skills in terms of preparing future leaders to be able to tackle the crisis head on with a sense of ambition, aggressiveness, and leadership. I think in both cases, there is not enough capacity and resources being deployed towards educating the next generation, and frankly, the current generation around these issues. From the technical standpoint, you know, I think in Taruna's point, to some degree, there's almost information overload where, you know, we've had so much science and scientific research being done on the issue of climate change, you know, talking about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports or looking at UN studies on climate change. There's a lot of information out there, but there's also an issue of access and equity associated with who's receiving that information. You know, for many communities, particularly in the global South, there is too little information. And so in that sense, more education, talking about climate science, talking about climate technologies and solutions are really important. In terms of the soft skills area, I think that's an area where right now there's no deliberate effort that I've seen in the US, in the communities that I've been a part of, to really foster that sense of emotional intelligence, of bold leadership to tackle this massive challenge. I don't think that there is enough investment in developing these future leaders. And I would think that from my perspective, one of the most important abilities that the education system needs to foster in youth is a systems thinking approach, an ability to connect the dots between different areas. You know, a lot of youth are doing that on their own. They're seeking out information. They're, you know, leaning into their ability to see the big picture. But I think that having more rigor and formal structure in the education system that enables that ability to cross the different silos and boundaries is super important.
Speaking of connecting the dots, you know, the challenges facing our communities today are always multifaceted. Climate intersects with social, political, and economic challenges and inequities in our societies. The term we use sometimes is a threat multiplier, which refers to climate change making other risks worse. How can we make visible these linkages that people sometimes conveniently ignore? And are you both optimistic that climate movements can drive forward real change?
So when we talk about making visible these linkages, I think they're plainly obvious right in front of us. I mean, even if we're not even talking about the United States itself, we, like Charles said, we look at the global South and we see that almost every aspect of people's lives are being impacted by climate change. The agricultural industry in India suffers inundating floods every year because of climate change. There's literal islands that are sinking because of climate change. Not even that, if we look at the United States here, marginalized communities like Black and Brown communities are more affected by climate-related issues than are others. For example, in Houston, where I used to live, the extremity of the natural disasters that we have been facing has increased. And not only that, the communities that were harmed were those that were in areas that were disproportionately populated by Black and Brown communities who didn't have access to the same resources. And I am optimistic that people will begin to see these linkages, but I think that we're past the point where beginning to see the linkages is where we need to be going. I think that forcefully addressing the issues at hand is what needs to happen. And as a young person, I'm not really sure exactly where to start doing that, because as Charles said, and going back to his point, we aren't given that education. We don't necessarily have all the technical knowledge that we do need. And I think it's like something that we put on ourselves to learn for ourselves. And that's something that can be really difficult.
Yeah, I think the term threat multiplier is such an apt term to describe the suite of issues that we're witnessing right in front of our eyes play out now. And that's things like, you know, ranging from migration, where, you know, we were talking about flooding in Pakistan and the impacts of a third of the country needing to be displaced due to the natural disaster there. and things will only intensify. You know, when we're talking about agriculture, like Aruna mentioned, that's, you know, something that my home state of even Wisconsin is already seeing, where climate change is impacting growing seasons. And that's had a massive effect on crop yields from farmers. We're talking about labor issues, deforestation in Brazil, the effects of a global of global warming and a hotter world on conflict in the Middle East. When we talk about the geopolitical issues associated with the energy crisis in Europe, you know, this is an issue that is truly global and unprecedented in scope and scale and speed, frankly. And in an increasingly global and globalized world that we're living in now, we've already seen how the impacts of things like pandemics, like with the COVID-19 crisis, how that has disrupted people's lives at a global scale. When we talk about sort of supply chain crises and how climate shocks and climate risks in certain sectors for certain resources and technologies have really disrupted supply chains at a global level, you know, this is going to increase the threats associated with, you know, military conflict, labor issues, forced migration and displacement, with natural disaster resilience and investments in recovery. At the same time, the solutions are also multidisciplinary and multifaceted, as you point out. And I think that there is reason for optimism in the sense that we increasingly have a literacy and a visibility and awareness around how policy impacts technology, which may impact sort of uptake in different regions and technological spillovers. And that may lead to more investment and drive forward societal understanding of the benefits of different clean energy technologies. So, you know, in an increasingly global world, I see that there is more of a recognition that to tackle this global challenge, we need global solutions. And that's things like, for example, the loss and damage fund that I was alluding to earlier, where, you know, whereas countries previously took a very unilateral approach to climate change and understanding that, you know, to reduce emissions domestically was kind of their focus, I think countries increasingly realize that that's an important step, but an insufficient step. And that understanding the contribution that they can make on the global stage is also very important. So, for example, the U.S., beyond just reducing its own emissions, has a role to play with deploying and developing clean energy technologies and producing innovations that reduce the costs of clean energy technologies everywhere, not just in the U.S. And so I think to tackle that second part of your question, how do we drive forward real change? It comes with first a basic recognition that global challenges that are fundamentally multifaceted require global and multifaceted solutions. And two, really pushing forward the timelines of everything that we've talked about. You know, there's an urgency to this issue. And so to the extent that we can reduce the cost of clean energy technologies, you know, drive forward climate cooperation and diplomatic agreements to create social infrastructure for more support for clean energy, all these different dimensions, we need to really accelerate things forward to drive forward the change that you allude to. That's very important.
Just a quick follow-up question, Charles. Because climate impacts are both global and localized, right? You mentioned the IPCC, you mentioned the Loss and Damage Fund. Are there possible actions outside of the UN system or the global system that could possibly be more effective in addressing the climate crisis? And also, like, how do we balance the bottom-up and the top-down?
It's a really great point about the kind of what I described as global, so global plus local dimensions of climate change, both the impacts, the solutions, and the processes. You know, there's one, I think, fundamental truth to the climate crisis, which is that those who are least responsible for causing the problem are the first, most, and worst impacted by the impacts of the climate crisis. And that's a problem. And that requires the fundamental retooling of the way that the global institutions and infrastructure that has historically been in place, you know, things, institutions like the United Nations or the World Bank or the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, and all these kind of multilateral bodies, there are certain power dynamics that fundamentally make it difficult to tackle this issue of climate justice on the international stage, right? When I talk about how Pakistan has contributed very little ultimately to the global climate crisis, but has been hit extremely hard by those challenges, that's not something that the UN or the World Bank is currently structured to do, frankly, because of the power dynamics that I mentioned, where in this case, the United States, which has been the historic largest emitter, needs to do a lot more to address climate impacts that we're already seeing, both from a mitigation standpoint to stop the bleeding, from a mitigation standpoint to make sure that these climate impacts don't get worse, but also from an adaptation standpoint to stop the bleeding. So, for example, with the World Bank, the United States under the Biden administration has nominated Ajay Banga, who was previously the CEO of MasterCard, to spearhead efforts moving forward. And that's a very difficult challenge, both from a technical perspective of how do you create the financing mechanisms, de-risk sort of climate investments in developing countries, and create the financial infrastructure to be able to deploy capital and properly assess risk so that the World Bank can make sure that with its limited resources, it's able to maximize impact. And I think that the Biden administration is trying to put forward somebody who has experience with significant amount of capital. As I mentioned, Ajay Banga being the former CEO of MasterCard, and seeing how we can incorporate climate risk and impact and opportunity into the World Bank's operations. And I think that's an important start. There's also the social, political, cultural dimension of, you know, how do you make sure that, for example, at the UN climate negotiations, the countries that I mentioned as being least responsible yet most impacted are actually provided a meaningful voice. So, for example, the G77 sort of framework of how do we make sure that what they are requesting, which are very reasonable asks, given that they're already experiencing climate impacts and climate disasters, are actually reflected in what the US and China and other global powers are committing to. And I'll just say very quick, I think, recently in the news, the island country of Vanuatu has made an appearance and a presence, and it's pushed relentlessly through the International Court of Justice to try to have standing on this question of what is the role of large, wealthy, powerful, and the countries that have been most responsible for climate change. How do we make sure that there's an accountability structure and framework in place to make sure that the damages that they have caused are actually accounted for? And, you know, that's an ongoing process. There's a lot of uncertainty there, but I think the results of that will be really revealing to understand how we may be able to create the political, legal, and social infrastructure in place to make sure that developed countries properly support developing countries in the clean energy transition.
If you don't mind, I'm just going to jump in here and say that I definitely agree with your points about the international stage and the UN and the World Bank. But there's also this realm of the private sector that I don't think gets addressed enough that can't be controlled by those international organizations. And I think that's something that a lot of youth climate activists today are focused on, is that there's a lot of private institutions which are contributing so much to fossil fuel development. And that's things like JP Morgan and Chase, where in 2020, they invested $51.3 billion into fossil fuel development and financing, or Bank of America with $42.1 billion. And those are tremendous amounts of money that are going directly into harming the environment. Like, I don't know how else to put it. And that there needs to be a focus on divestment, which is what a lot of young people today are doing, because from our perspective, or from the people that I've interacted with, we've sensed this frustration that international organizations like the UN, especially with the non-binding aspect of everything that's passed and all the resolutions that are passed, with the exemption of the Security Council, there's not really anything that the UN can do to hold anyone accountable. And I think that from a citizen perspective, divesting from those institutions is something that everyone can do. Pulling your money out of banks like JP Morgan and Chase, Bank of America, is something that we can all do.
On the topic of environmental justice, in your opinion, what is getting in the way of empowering everyone to engage in climate action? Can we achieve true co-leadership and leverage all these learnings to advance action?
So there's a phrase which is that those closest to the pain must be closest to the power. And that's been cited by many folks, particularly in the US in terms of environmental justice leaders. And I think it's very true because, like I mentioned earlier, the people, the communities, the countries, the citizens that are most impacted by climate change oftentimes have the least power, the least platform, the sort of least developed platforms to be able to voice their perspectives on climate change. And that needs to change. That has to be a global conversation where that takes both continued push from the global south to advocate for themselves and for these marginalized communities to continue building the political momentum. But on the flip side, it really needs to be those in power and positions of power right now. That's, you know, the global north, that's developed countries, that's in a more domestic sense, that's sort of elected officials, decision makers, policymakers, to really recognize that in order to have true justice in the climate and clean energy transition, those communities need to be given a voice in the development, the design, and the implementation of climate policies. In addition, I think that it's very important for all sorts of stakeholders to recognize that justice is not a secondary component of climate action. You know, there's this idea that in the past, environmental justice tends to slow things down where, you know, maybe you have to take more time to engage with communities in developing a renewable energy or a fossil fuel project, or maybe you need to kind of raise the costs of the project in order to actually effectively engage with these stakeholders. But I don't think that's true. In fact, you know, as the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is implemented, as more and more clean energy projects are built out, if we don't take environmental justice into consideration, we'll not only recreate the existing challenges and injustices that we've seen with economic disparities and environmental disparities that different communities face, but also we won't be able to build the durable political and social support to make sure that the climate transition actually carries out as quickly as possible. So I think climate action and environmental justice are part and parcel. They have to be linked together.
Yeah, I had to take some time to think about that, but I definitely agree with Charles in that there's an intersection between environmental justice and social justice. A lot of the times it falls on the shoulders of the citizens of nations to tackle these monumental changes. But like Charles said, it's really the responsibility of those in power. However, we in the United States, if we're talking domestically, we're lucky enough to have a system in which there is the sort of democratic sense of some sort in which citizen voices really can have an impact on what national policymaking is. For example, the current Biden administration has an ambitious climate goal that I'm very happy with. Of course, it could be better, but it meets the UN demands. But in countries that don't have that same privilege, I think it becomes more difficult. And I think that's when our conversation shifts to China, in which there are youth climate activists in China currently, but they don't have the same opportunities or voices and the freedoms that people in the global north have. And I think that going back to Charles's point, it really is the responsibility of the biggest global emitters per capita, like the United States, to continue investment in renewable energy development. And I don't want to seem like an interventionist, but and spread that wealth to the rest of the world as well, because we are the largest emitters per capita per person. And I think it can be kind of frustrating whenever we have an institution in place in the United States in which elected officials are supposed to be listening to the citizenry, but the thing is they don't. And it goes back to the notion of those in power will do anything they can to keep that power. And a lot of that power comes from fossil fuel development, especially in the South.
Every generation has its role to play in addressing climate change. What roles do you both see for older people? From one generation older to the elderly, what are their responsibilities?
I think that's a really important question. So first, I'll just say why intergenerational dialogue, collaboration, and solidarity is important. And my view on that is that climate change is a fundamentally multidisciplinary, multifaceted, and multi-stakeholder challenge. It's massive in the complexity, the difficulty, the size of the issue. And, you know, different generations have different things to offer to climate action. young people have their voice, their perspectives, their energy, their urgency, their passion to bring to this issue. And older generations have the expertise, the experience, the knowledge, frankly, the financial resources, and these other dimensions that are also crucial. They also, I would say most importantly, occupy positions of leadership, power, and decision-making influence, as well as impact. And that's critical because to the extent that we can make sure that these opportunities and positions of influence reflect intergenerational perspectives, I think that's very important. You know, that's things like nonprofit or for-profit boards. That's things like elected office. That's things like corporate leaders and who's actually calling the shots and actually making the decisions. It needs to be a truly diverse set of perspectives, not just with age, but also gender, race, and all other demographics that are very important. So I think to the extent that older generations can, to borrow a phrase that I've heard many times, of passing the torch, of making sure that, you know, if you think about it like a relay race where older generations are passing the baton to younger generations as they increasingly retire and as younger generations increasingly assume positions of leadership and power, they need to make sure that there's a smooth handoff, that the transition is smooth, and that younger folks are actually equipped with the resources, the know-how, the expertise to be able to tackle the climate crisis. So to the extent that we can make sure that older generations financially and intellectually and socially support younger generations in developing these leadership, emotional intelligence, and other capacities that are critical to address this challenge head on, I think that's going to be very important.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The only thing I have to add on to that is that it is, yes, the job of the older generation to be equipping young people with those skills like leadership and critical thinking. But the thing is, it's also the responsibility of the older generation currently who are in power, like you said, to be addressing the issue head on for themselves. And a lot of that comes with, for the general citizenry, that comes with voting in the United States, voting out people who don't believe in climate change, but also educating themselves on the issues at hand. Because we can't have older generations educating younger generations when a majority of people, as we see by the voting records in the United States, don't truly understand the severity of climate-based issues. And I think that's really making a resurgence right now, especially as we head into a lot of statewide elections.
I want to bring up the US-China context before we wrap up. Although climate issues are primarily a global challenge, the US and China being the largest emitters have the power to accelerate global progress in climate action. From working together, separately, or even competing, how do we solve climate issues in a world where it's increasingly politically infeasible to work together with China? How can young people do to help?
I think that's a really important point, particularly as the US and China, they're the historic largest emitters and they're the current largest emitters. They account for nearly half of global emissions today. So the US and China's leadership role is absolutely paramount to tackling the climate crisis, particularly as China continues to grow. At the same time, they have bold commitments, the US of reaching net zero emissions by 2050 and China of reaching net zero emissions by 2060. Of course, the proof is in the pudding. For the US and China to actually reach these goals, there is a lot more work that needs to be done. There needs to be continued development of clean energy technologies, both traditional ones like solar and wind, but also advanced energy technologies like geothermal, nuclear, hydrogen, and other technologies like long-duration battery storage. So there needs to be development of these technologies, but there also needs to be deployment, right? Not only domestically, where the US and China both need to aggressively get these clean energy technologies into the domestic markets and make sure that they displace fossil fuel generation, but also internationally. Again, the US and China have a lot of financial and physical resources that they can contribute to the global climate fight in terms of getting these technologies built all over the world. So for example, in China's case with the Belt and Road Initiative, making sure that projects are actually developed with climate and sustainability as a key consideration in mind. or the US with its contributions to global financial institutions, both in the private sector, like the banks, but also in the public and quasi-public sector, like with multilateral development banks, making sure that climate is the number one consideration in financing of projects and deployment of capital to low-income countries. And I think one sort of challenge to your point is that there is a lack of dialogue right now and lack of discourse and productive conversation between the two countries, although that's ebbed and flowed with changing geopolitical tensions. And, you know, currently there's minimal dialogue. But also the, I would say, a bigger problem in many ways is that younger folks need to foster this dialogue too. And there aren't current structures in place for young Americans and young Chinese individuals who are very passionate about climate change to really have a meaningful dialogue. I think that infrastructure needs to be in place towards this goal of having a, what I like to call a co-optition model, where there needs to be collaboration between these two countries in terms of, again, clean energy innovation, deployment of capital and technologies in a global scale. But also there, it does need to be a degree of healthy competition too, in terms of driving down the costs of building resilient supply chains, of supporting domestic needs while ensuring that, you know, that these technologies continue to advance and become modernized. So I would say, to the extent that young people can start having that dialogue and fill the void that currently exists at a more top-down level of global leaders not engaging as much as they perhaps should or need to on this issue, young people can start to increasingly fill that void, have these conversations, particularly between Americans, Asian Americans, and Chinese individuals, and students and young scholars, to really propel this conversation forward and put pressure on older generations unilaterally and bilaterally to address this issue.
For me, I feel like, I think the challenges for each generation in each country are vastly different. I think in the United States, as I said earlier, we, as young people, we have the opportunity to sort of address the challenges and have that freedom to address the government. But in China, that doesn't really exist. So there are organizations in place like the China Youth Climate Action Network, which was founded in 2007, but their goals are vastly different, because I don't know if everyone listening would know this, but in China, you must get the government's approval to form any type of political protest or any protest in general following 1989. So the goal of the China Youth Climate Action Network, contrary to in the United States, how we tend to advocate for governmental change, is that they advocate for local change instead, sort of equipping local communities with the capacity and education to understand climate action, as well as what they can do individually. And also sort of they're equipping local communities with the capacity to cope with more climate disasters. So in that aspect, I feel as though, yes, there needs to be communication between the younger generations of China and the United States, but the issues that they're facing are vastly different. And I'm not really sure if there's a platform in place that allows for that communication. I currently work on a journal, and any sort of article that we write that has anything to do with opposing the party line in China gets automatically censored through WeChat. So we've been facing a lot of difficulty with doing that as well. So I feel like sometimes that it's kind of optimistic to look at this area and say, oh, we need to just talk to each other whenever those channels of communication are so limited. But at the same time, like, that does need to happen. I'm just not sure how. But there has been collaboration between the United States and China in the past when addressing climate-based issues. In just 2020, I believe there was a U.S.-China joint Glasgow Declaration on Enhancing Climate Action, in which both countries pledged to work together. And I think emanating those values and continuing to support positions like this and continuing that collaboration is extremely important.
These are really great thoughts and ideas. Aruna and Charles, thank you so much for joining us today and for the interesting conversation. It was a pleasure speaking with you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. Thank you for listening.